Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. Sending in for Andrew Tuck this week, I'm Carlotta Ribello. Coming up on the programme.
Thanks to the Humble Lift, the tallest buildings in the world are today hundreds of metres high, and plans for the first 1,000-metre tower are underway in Saudi Arabia.
How we make better cities, places that deliver quality of life for all, has been the core issue of this programme since it started. Whether you're a campaigner, planner, or simply someone who wants better public spaces, it's important for all of us to feel part of our city's story. All these issues that we've been discussing through the years here at Monocle come together in a new book, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities. And all this month, here on The Urbanist, we'll take a sneak peek at some of the pages and bring those words to life. So, are you ready to join us? That's coming up right now on The Urbanist with me, Carlotta Ribello. So welcome to this week's programme unpacking our brand new book, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities. In total, we've put together 11 chapters across roughly 300 pages, exploring crucial themes for the cities of today, from leisure and pleasure to workspaces, the importance of culture, mobility and more. We also bring you a series of essays looking at some of the challenges our urban areas face today and how cities would be nothing without the people who inhabit them. To get us started, we're off to Rome, where Monocle's correspondent in the city, David Pleasant, tells us about his troubled love affair with the Eternal City.
To call the current state of Rome just disastrous would be an understatement in a city accustomed to magnificent superlatives. Every day seems to bring news of yet another urban calamity. Large chunks of streets and their haphazardly parked cars disappear into sinkholes. Then the effects of the snow and ice bring the city to its knees. And most dramatically, a total lack of maintenance causes buses to explode on central streets and avenues. These are but a few of the incidents that Romans are expected to take in their stride. Rome is often described as ungovernable, and as a new resident to the city, this was hard to come to terms with. Yet its hint of lawlessness and adamant informality also means that Romans you've just met will happily invite you to dinner that night and insist you bring a friend too. In the streets and piazzas, a choreographed chaos pervades. Here you can have a cappuccino, no flat whites, grazie, in a tiny cafe or opulent bar, and it will taste the same, resoundingly delicious. Of course, the daily grind in Rome throws up plenty of challenges. If you're reliant on public transport, the general advice is don't be. But the thousands of potholes dotting the city's ancient streets also make getting around by scooter or bike an increasingly precarious activity. Then again, everyday life is infused with flavours that go a long way to making up for those transport trials and rush hour mayhem. Indeed, that a good plate of seasonal and locally grown delicacies nourishes the soul in a way that no chain restaurant ever could is emblematic of the lack of showiness that dominates the Roman way of life. Just because a Negroni costs €3 and might be served in a plastic cup doesn't make it any less delectable. As spring brings blue skies and perfectly agreeable evenings, residents revert to the outdoors, and those who are fortunate enough to have a terrazza often assume the role of host by default. For those who like rules and a sense of civic order, the Italian capital may be too much to stomach. Certainly, the parlous state of the city's finances and public services is not something to shrug off. That would seem glib, given the inconvenience and waste that this city's degrado, or deterioration, is causing its inhabitants. Yet, just as Roman infrastructure and urban complexities throw a spanner in the works of efficiency, the Roman cuisine helps to slow the metabolism to a pleasantly unrushed pace. In Rome, residents can only hope to be happy if they let the rhythms and routine of the city hold sway. In the Eternal City, that's the difference between eternal frustration and eternal fulfillment.
That was Monocle's Rome correspondent, David Pleasant. Now, there are small fixes and innovations that massively changed the way we live and think about our urban spaces. Just pause for a moment and ponder, what would New York, Tokyo or Singapore look like had the lift never been invented at all? Here's the essay by Monocle's executive editor, Matt Alagaya, in praise of the lift.
Elisha Graves Otis may not be a household name, but he has arguably done more to shape cities around the world over the past 160 years than any mayor, president, or planner. While he wasn't actually the inventor of the lift, as many erroneously believe, he did devise the safety brake in 1852, which meant elevators could be trusted for the first time. Before then, constructing buildings of more than 6 or 7 stories was pointless, because few people were willing to trudge up that many flights of stairs. With the emergence of the safe lift, all that changed. Ever since, our cities have bloomed, growing upwards as fast as outwards and scaling new heights worldwide. Thanks to the humble lift, the tallest buildings in the world are today hundreds of meters high, and plans for the first 1,000-meter tower are underway in Saudi Arabia. While it's important to remember that the most pleasant cities around the world retain a degree of human scale, it's impossible to deny that our cities have needed to become denser to accommodate growing populations. The lift has helped us achieve that and will do so even more in the future. If it's astounding how much the lift has shaped our cities over the past century, it's equally astonishing that the basic technology that transports human beings up and down buildings has barely changed since Otis's day. The same 4 fundamental ingredients, ropes, brakes, a counterweight and a cab, are still used in almost every lift in the world. But that too is now changing. The engineers at ThyssenKrupp Elevator, one of the 4 big global lift manufacturers, have come up with a design called the Multi, which disposes of ropes and instead drives through a system similar to magnetic levitation, which is used by some modern trains. And whereas most lift shafts can only accommodate 1 cab, the Multi's shafts will be able to carry multiple cabs, which will be able to move both vertically and horizontally. If none of this sounds particularly groundbreaking, allow me to wheel out an industry heavyweight. The editors of leading industry publication Elevator World have described the removal of ropes from lifts as the industry's holy grail. ThyssenKrupp's invention will once again shift the economics and possibilities of the construction industry, enabling developers to build towers that reach more than a kilometre in height. And whether we like it or not, we may well need such soaring skyscrapers in the future, as our cities become megacities and our megacities become something that we can scarcely imagine today. But don't take my word for it. Executives at major lift manufacturers are confident about the future. They know their market is only set to grow in the years and decades to come. Let their confidence be a sign. We'd better get used to living at greater and greater heights.
Thank you, Matt. That was Monocle's executive editor, Matt Alagaya. Coming up next, how European cities have dealt with the refugee crisis. When the refugee crisis knocked on Europe's door in the months leading up to the summer of 2015, it didn't prompt an immediate response from officials. It took the capsizing of a makeshift raft off the coast of Libya, which claimed the lives of nearly 800 people, along with a tragic photograph of Alan Kurdi, the 3-year-old Syrian baby who drowned on a Turkish beach, for any reaction to kick in.
Meeting an emergency session to discuss Europe's migration crisis, EU interior ministers are on collision course over proposals to distribute asylum seekers across the continent.
Prompted by the prime ministers of Italy, France and Malta, an emergency meeting between EU interior ministers was called, and one of the key decisions made was that each European member state would take in a set number of refugees, the infamous migrant quotas.
If we think that the issue can be left to a single country, to your neighbor, to someone else, we are risking a lot.
In the months that followed, many cities opened their doors of schools, community centers, and public housing and became veritable havens of safety. In 2018, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees estimated that more than half of the world's 22.5 million refugees lived in urban areas. Yet, often cities officials, planners and architects are brought into the conversation too late and end up working towards minimizing bad decisions rather than initiating positive solutions. This is one of the main reasons behind the failure of refugee camps. In the absence of urban planners, it's often up to savvy entrepreneurs and local activists to step up to the challenges. Robert Barr is the CEO and founder of Jobs for Refugees in Germany. Originally from Munich, he decided to create his company after witnessing hundreds of refugees arriving at the city's main train station in 2015.
Munich railway station has until now been the terminus for migrants and refugees making their way to Germany. From here, they're bused or take trains to other states outside Bavaria. But with 12,000 people arriving in one go on Saturday, the biggest one-day influx so far, Munich is full.
At one point, during that summer, a reported 10,000 migrants were arriving in Germany every day. So it's no surprise that many of these quick-thinking grassroots organizations came into being at that time. It was then that Marik Gieling and Jonas Kakoschke created Refugees Welcome, a sort of immigrant Airbnb for new arrivals that matched people who had a spare room with those in need of shelter. A number of cafes, clubs and restaurants across Berlin displayed a Refugees Welcome banner, inviting newcomers into the city. Long before the photographs of refugees crossing Europe on foot were splashed across the front pages around the world, the crisis had been quietly unfolding on the shores of the Mediterranean. Greece, along with Italy, was one of the first entry points for many migrants. And in cities such as Rome, Naples, Athens and Thessaloniki, all of which were, at the time, grappling with their own challenges through budget cuts and years of austerity, that integration becomes even more essential. Giorgos Kaminis was at the start of his second term as mayor of Athens while the crisis was unfolding. For him, the biggest issue was that it was impossible to measure what the magnitude of the situation would be. But while those first months were rough, with his city seeing a record number of migrants sleeping on its streets and in its squares, City Hall stepped up to the challenge. Kaminis' office created temporary accommodation to house 3,000 refugees, and the municipal radio station, Athens 984, started broadcasting news bulletins in Arabic as well as Greek. The infrastructure for coping with refugees in European cities has come a long way since that summer of 2015, in part thanks to local urban heroes. New enterprises have ranged from an Arabic language bookshop in Amsterdam to a Syrian restaurant in the heart of Lisbon, and even a theatre company thriving at the heart of the now defunct Calais camp in France. Refugee or not, we all move to cities looking for something, be it a better job, a journey of self-discovery, or an improvement to our quality of life. And the reason the move works is because cities quickly make us feel at home. It's paramount that those who are responsible for making cities, from planners and architects to activists and academics, are engaged from the start. History is cyclical, and as our urban areas continue to grow, it's likely that another refugee crisis will emerge not long after this one. When that day comes, cities have to be fully prepared to what they have always been, places of refuge. It's time now for us to head to Perth as our own fashion editor, Jamie Waters, brings us his ode to suburbia.
Growing up in Perth in the 1990s meant growing up in sun-kissed suburbia. We played on streets lined with weeping peppermint trees and rode our scooters to the tennis club after school. We stuck to the leafy suburbs, which are flanked on either side by stretches of water, the Indian Ocean and the Swan River. Visits to the city, or CBD, were rare. Trips to the beach were frequent. Imagine if American Beauty was transported to the seaside, and you get the gist. Our scooters were soon replaced with second-hand cars. Obtaining a driver's license is a big deal here. This is a car city. The suburbs are strung out along the coast, connected by parkland and motorways, so there's a sizeable distance between hubs. Each neighbourhood, or clutch of neighbourhoods, has a village-like nucleus, whether Claremont in the affluent western suburbs or Fremantle, the historic port, to the south. Perth is best enjoyed in a car, with the windows down and radio up. During high school and university, summer nights were spent driving around with friends. Inevitably, these trips ended up with us sitting on the bonnet in one of the parks overlooking the Swan River, the blue lifeblood of the city. At its best, on a warm evening in December, the air still and lights from waterfront homes sparkling, Perth is a hard place to top. People from other Australian cities refer to the Western Australian capital as a big country town, and there is some merit to that. It has always felt sleepier than its sizeable population, about 2 million, suggests. This is attributable to its isolation and, historically, the lack of a bustling CBD. There is a high quality of life here. It's one of the wealthiest and sunniest cities in Australia, and the pace is slower. Businessmen surf before work and families have riverside picnics for dinner. In the past decade, however, the world's most isolated state capital city has experienced a shift. It has grown up, shedding some of its languid vibe and become more big city. The mining boom that started in 2009 and soared until 2014 brought huge injections of cash and people to the city. While the rest of the world plummeted with the financial crisis, Western Australians were rolling in iron ore money. There was much chatter about cashed-up bogans, men who did shift work in mining towns and splashed cash on water skis and holiday homes. At its peak in 2012, the mining industry was worth 120 billion Australian dollars. With the mining money came big infrastructure projects, two state-of-the-art hospitals, a new AFL stadium, the Elizabeth Quay waterfront retail development, a public library, the first civic building to be erected since the 1970s, and a gilded hotel and casino called Crown Perth. What will be the biggest building in the city is currently under construction, a multi-purpose development at Belmont Park Racecourse that, once completed, will provide 4,500 apartments. The boom may be over, but it has left Perth with this impressive hardware and brought life to the city centre. There are more attractions for tourists and locals alike. Inner city living is now the norm for young people who have moved into red brick townhouses in CBD abutting neighbourhoods. Projects such as the five-starred Como the Treasury Hotel have brought razzmatazz, and the scene has been bolstered by the relaxation of drinking laws, which has seen small bars spring up. Perth possesses extreme versions of all the characteristics that are particular to Australia. Australia's weather is good, Perth's is exceptionally so. Australia is isolated, yet no city is more isolated than Perth. Indeed, this isolation is both its greatest asset and Achilles' heel. On the one hand, it gives the city a sense of escapism and means there are plenty of jobs. Many international companies have Perth branches because the city is so far from anywhere else. Yet with isolation also comes parochialism, claustrophobia, and a brain drain of talent to Sydney, Melbourne, and London. This oil painting of a city is bigger than ever with its new CBD. Yet the real heart of Perth is not found in these multi-billion dollar developments, but in the small suburban hubs dotted along the water, in the beach cafes, riverside bars, and sun-drenched tennis clubs.
That was Monocle's fashion editor, Jamie Waters. As our cities grow, it's important to remember that we grow with them too. Architecture can go a long way into building age-friendly cities, but this is a discussion that should start at schools or in informal conversations so that meaningful change can actually happen. To tell us more about ageing in place, here's Monocle's senior, well, not that kind of senior, correspondent. Here's Sophie Grove.
I have a running joke with my nonagenarian neighbour across the hall. How's Lebrexit? he asks me when I meet him on the landing of our Parisian apartment block. And how are Winston and Elizabeth, his pet names for my children? A resident of 40 years, he is bright, brisk and courteous. He walks stick in hand to the boulangerie each day and buys Le Monde to read after lunch.
Bonjour.
Urban life suits him, and why shouldn't it? There's a lift, public transport and cafes. Much has changed in the 6th arrondissement, but there are still quiet bookshops and a puzzling density of pharmacies. It's strange the inner city has become so synonymous with youth. Undoubtedly, frenetic urban landscapes appeal to a fit, fun-loving, working-age demographic. Yet city life, with its tight social structures and proximity to healthcare, parks and shops, is really just as suited to the old. In any case, data shows that our cities are ageing fast. In places such as New York, there are now more people over the age of 65 than there are children under 5. London's 60-plus demographic is expected to expand by 48% by 2035. Traditionally, many urban elders would have retired to the coast or the country, but this is changing. Older residents are staying put, and there's anecdotal evidence that affluent retirees are migrating back to the city in search of a dynamic social scene, a rich, car-free cultural life, and proximity to grandchildren. We're seeing a blurring of life phases, says Dean Simpson, an architect who teaches at the Royal Danish Academy of Fine Arts in Copenhagen and has studied urban retirement towns from Florida to Japan. Many people want to continue to work well after retirement, he told me. People are generally not as likely to move to Florida. They're more interested in staying in their social and spatial networks. The idea of aging in place is fast replacing the concept of housing older people in faraway communities. There's even an acronym, NORC, Naturally Occurring Retirement Community, to describe the urban settlements that become magnets for an older crowd. Developers, architects, and city planners are facing up to the need for an age-friendly urban landscape. Yet the private sector seems slow to realise the potential for an urban retirement concept that leans on the amenities of the city and its adaptable housing stock. There are exceptions, of course. In the Copenhagen district of Norebro, Danish architect firm C.F. Müller is creating a project known as Solund, a multi-generational development that will house the city's largest care centre, a nursery, youth housing and a senior community. Here, every detail has been configured to make sure generations collide and interact. It's about creating corridors that act as social hubs where people can stop and form relationships, says Solund's project leader, Mads Mandrup Hansen. Architecture is key, but making cities more age-friendly requires a political and cultural shift. After all, what's the point of beautiful parks if young people jog aggressively through them within a whisker of someone recovering from hip surgery? It's about reimagining the public sphere. You have to get the highest political support, says Paul McGarry, who's in charge of the Greater Manchester Ageing Hub. You have to create a platform for older people to be involved in decisions at every civic level. You've got to find space to make an effort to give people agency. Manchester is one of the World Health Organization's age-friendly cities and is working with Barcelona, Gothenburg and Amsterdam to raise the bar. McGarry describes a push at every level, from infrastructure to health and city planning, all with older residents in mind. Getting businesses to understand the potential that older people represent as customers and entrepreneurs has been key. We don't want our cities to be giant temples to youth. It's clear that a dynamic, intergenerational mix is vital to a healthy, happy, balanced society. The very old and the very young changed the pace and timbre of life for the better. Instead of being siphoned off from each other, they should be brought together to exchange thoughts, jokes, reassurance, and historic perspectives. "I've been a Gaullist since 1941, my neighbour exclaimed the other morning, as he insisted I take the lift up before him. "Churchill was an exceptional man. You see, I'm an Anglophile, despite Le Brexit. You will always be our allies."
Thank you, Sophie. That was Monocle's Sophie Grove. It's almost time to head off, but before we do, let's cross over to Asia, where our Hong Kong bureau chief, James Chambers, tells us all about Asia's outdoor living rooms.
Shanghai is China's ultra-modern city of neon lights, commerce, and sprightly seniors going for evening strolls in their pajamas. For me, witnessing this nocturnal activity was an early introduction into how the streets in Asian cities are often an extension of individual living space. Growing up in the West, hanging out on the street was considered antisocial, bordering on criminal behavior. But by contrast, in Asian cities, everything is allowed to hang out. From washing in Hangzhou to badminton nets in Hanoi. Kids play, businessmen hawk, and car horns honk. Street life in Asian cities is more lively than the West, and it's not just amid the dust and detritus of developing cities in Southeast Asia. The thing that struck me most when I moved to Hong Kong from London is just how much time I spend outside. Weather certainly plays a part, although outside does not always mean outdoors. Teenage couples, for example, are a common sight in shopping malls late at night, once all the shop shutters are down. Cities such as Jakarta, Manila, and even Singapore are routinely ranked the world's most densely populated urban areas. With living space at a premium, private life naturally spills into the public realm. Of course, this is nothing new, but the traffic is. Chu Kim Duk co-founded Think Playgrounds in Hanoi in 2014 to provide a safe place for children to play in the Vietnamese capital. "When I was a child, we didn't have playgrounds," she says. "We played on the empty streets." As cities grow, mayors and urban planners will have to get creative. Indonesia's third largest city of Bandung has set a useful precedent here. An initiative from City Hall, called the Taman Film Bandung, installed a cinema screen underneath an overpass and covered the ground with artificial grass. People took off their shoes and stopped littering, and it became an urban living room, says its co-designer Daliana Suryawinata, a director of architecture firm SHAU. Like Bandung, more Asian cities should focus on providing a pleasant, safe, outdoor environment for its residents, rather than pushing everyone inside an air-conditioned box and labeling it progress. Spotting a pajama-clad senior in Shanghai is less common nowadays, and that's a huge shame.
Thanks, James. That was Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief, James Chambers. And that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. Remember to join us next week as we continue to unpack our brand new book, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities. You can grab your own copy at any good bookstore or, of course, at monocle.com. This show was produced by myself and edited by David Stevens. I'm Carlotta Ribello, standing in for Andrew Tuck. And don't worry, he'll be back next week. Now, to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, here's Stevie Wonder with Living for the City. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.
A boy's born in hot damn Mississippi, surrounded by for world that ain't so pretty. His parents give him love and affection to keep him strong, moving in.